From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to Esteli in Nicaragua to speak with journalist Stephen Sefton about last weekend's and this coming weekend's elections in Latin America. Stephen, welcome. We're glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, Don. And as usual, there's quite a lot to talk about. It's a little bit more intense than usual because of the electoral cycle. But And so we've got a lot of ground to cover.
And we're going to be looking at two today, I guess, right? First, the just passed election in Chile. And there's some interesting observations there looking at some of the data. And it's important, of course, with the history of Chile generally, particularly in the period since Pinochet took power and Allende was elected and then murdered. And then the coming election this weekend in Honduras, which is also a very key election. This is another country that went left and saw a coup d'etat backed by the United States during the Obama administration. And, the death squads and such return. And now it looks like the left has a solid chance at the polls again this coming weekend. So we'll start with Chile, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, and if you'll permit me, Don, I think we should also, although you did cover it in depth with Dan Kovalik earlier this week, we should also mention that this is taking place in the context of a really exceptional win for the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela.
This is very, very important coloring for the entire conversation in terms of background and actually context in three dimensions because, as goes Venezuela thus far, we have seen the hemisphere starting to go in that direction. They were pretty close to the beginning of the real assemblage of this entire project, although Cuba and Nicaragua and early 70s Chile and others have been trying to express this condition, even going back to Guatemala and other places. Venezuela has been kind of like the architect of the most recent attempts to realize Bolivar's vision for the region, an independent region with self-determination, dignity, a collective sense of purpose.
Yeah, and I think there's something absolutely fundamental, really fundamental about when we're talking about the elections in Chile and Honduras right now, but when we're talking about elections in general in the region. And it seems to me that what Venezuela and Nicaragua and the Cuban Revolution have contributed to the overall context in which people are taking decisions about their political future is that there is a real socialist alternative, an alternative focused very much prioritizing the needs of the human person in terms of healthcare, education, housing, employment, and basic human dignity, fundamental human dignity.
Right.
And what the Venezuelan election has demonstrated last Sunday, and what the Nicaraguan election demonstrated the previous weekend, was that when people are given the chance to vote for that, they vote for it en masse.
Right. That's right.
Right? Okay, so and it seems to me that we need to bear that in mind when we're looking at Chile and Honduras. Now, in Chile, that option isn't really there. And that explains why the turnout, what was the turnout around 47%?
Yeah, this is a presidential election now. When we were talking last week, and when I was speaking earlier with Dan this week about Venezuela, when we were speaking about Nicaragua last week and other places regarding municipal elections, municipal elections, like in the United States, have a much lower turnout than those, considered of national import, because you might be discussing during the course of a campaign some local policy issue or some local project that have impact. Generally, the direction of the nation is perceived to be decided with presidential and legislative elections, and in a very real sense, it's true that that's the way it is. Consequently, in any event, for whatever reason, you have turnout in the range generally of 60 to 70 or even 80% where you have, you know, vast mass participation in the electoral process, like in places like Nicaragua.
Right.
Here in the United States, like the record one for this century was the last 2020 election, and the turnout there was around 65%. But the election this year, right here in my own community, right in Westchester County and in the town and village of Ossining, was between 12 and 28% turnout.
Right.
So in Chile, you had 40-something percent turnout for a presidential election, which is less than you have in the United States, which has one of the worst records on this. And so what you're saying is the reason for that is that the people didn't really feel like they were being presented with the alternative that they wanted.
Right, and because what they see is what they say to themselves is, well, what's the point of voting if it isn't going to make any difference to my life?
Right,
and which is, you know, totally understandable, isn't it? And so, in Chile, what the two main choices were Gabriel Boric, a kind of vaguely left wing social democrat type. Who managed to come out on top in the primaries from the voting of a very disunited and incoherent left-wing movement, which, despite being able to get out on the streets and force the right-wing authorities under the government of Sebastián Piñera to yield on the issue of holding a constituent assembly to draft a new constitution for Chile, they have been unable to mobilize that level of support or that level of motivated support for the candidates that came out on top in the primary, and in this case Gabriel Boric. And he came second in the first round of the presidential vote with something like 26-27%, and an outright fascist, José Antonio Kast, came first in the first round with 29% of the vote. Now, how do you explain that? How do you explain that somebody who is even more right wing than an outright fascist like Sebastián Piñera, who ordered the police to viciously repress the initial protests in Chile over the past 2 years. You know, and hundreds of people were deliberately targeted by the paramilitary Chilean police, the Carabinieri, who deliberately fired shotgun pellets at their eyes. And so you've got hundreds of young people, right, mainly young people in Chile, who are out in those demonstrations, who are now either completely blind or have severe problems with their vision because they were wounded in their eyes by this policy of the Carabinieri. That was when they weren't deliberately running people over with their vehicles and shooting them dead or shooting them in the, using live rounds to shoot them and wound them just for being out on the streets. And that is what happened in the early period of the demonstrations. And subsequently, when that became impossible to justify and that level of repression became totally counterproductive, Piñera and his accomplices toned down the repression, but it's still a very real repression. And despite that, this tremendous popular movement in Chile managed to secure a commitment to a referendum, which their forces won. And now there's going to be a constituent assembly, but it's going to now take place in the context of an essentially reactionary conventional political system. And it's very difficult to see how Chile is going to make progress in terms of the development of social and economic and political alternatives benefiting the majority of the population in that context.
Right.
So it seems to me that vote in Chile was very, very telling about the situation in the countries of the Southern Cone, like Uruguay, Paraguay, Chile, Argentina, that are still suffering the inherited effects of the dictatorships of the 70s and 80s, which wiped out radical left-wing political forces in those countries. And what you've had in particular in Chile is this kind of pseudo left, this pseudo progressive, pseudo humanitarian social democrat dominated alternative to the right wing.
Right.
And that has produced people like Michelle Bachelet and all the scientists who you know, just a complete tool of the United States,
right,
and completely incapable of doing anything to dismantle the legacy of Pinochet in terms of socially progressive measures, unable to confront the fascist characteristics of Chile's police, the Carabinieri,
right,
unable to address in a progressive way the situation of the country's indigenous Mapuche peoples, which continues to be a gross anomaly in terms of Chile's political development in a regional context. Chile has been unable to meet the legitimate demands of their indigenous Mapuche majority in very similar way to the similar failure in Argentina.
Right.
Not quite so chronic as in Chile, but still an essentially a failure. So that accumulated failure of the social democrat progressives, kind of center-left, you might call them, forces in Chile to resolve the problems of the significant impoverished sections of Chile's population has led to this situation where the great majority of working people, working class people, don't bother voting because they see
right.
it as
making
no difference to their lives, whereas as you and I pointed out before we started recording this conversation, if you go to the corresponding rich areas, the wealthier areas right. of Chile's electoral map, you see that in those areas, the turnout to vote overwhelmingly for the right-wing options, electoral options, is up around 65% to 70%.
Right. It's an entirely different model. And also, the breakdown of the vote is interesting, too, because forget for a moment that we're actually talking about both parties that were represented by these two candidates, or both blocs represented by these two candidates, are actually bourgeois parties, bourgeois constructs. In other words, in either way, are going to serve the bourgeoisie, the 1%, the elite, whatever you'd like, and also, by the way, the U.S. and European multinational corporations, and Japanese, too. In addition to that, fall-off and turnout in the working-class neighborhoods, the vote is split between the two different manifestations of bourgeois party, the 2-1, with 1/3 of the people voting in working class districts that do vote, voting for the most repressive bourgeois party, in other words, the right wing fascist party, rather than the fascism with a human face neoliberal that'll be the death of neoliberalism party, which is what was represented by Boric. And so you have a situation where, on the one hand, a lot of the working class just sits on its hands because there is nothing in the electoral system for them. And then out of those that say, well, look, I have to engage at this level, 1/3 of them engage by finding the most oppositional to their own interests to vote for. So that leaves a situation.
And people may listen to the way I talk about the right-wing forces in Chile and say, oh, well, he's exaggerating. Of course, they're not really fascists. Well, they are.
They are. In each case, by the way, even you know, we're talking about this. Again, this candidate, he's in his 30s. He had a little McGovern aspect to him, too, in terms of trying to, you know, I guess it worked for in 1972 here to try to bury any kind of rising left. By the way, yes, I was in a psychiatric hospital, and I have OCD. He admitted this publicly as the, you know, standard bearer of the left, quote unquote. Of course, he didn't have a left program. And the things that he promised to try to work on in this hostile environment where the hard right has an awful lot of control across the board, lingering from Pinochet's day, was, well, maybe we're going to try to get public ownership of the water supplies again. You know, even things that even the United States has, they're going to try to get finally. No one talking about workers taking control of the means of production or the government charting out an independent foreign policy from the United States. God help us. That wasn't on the table.
And you see, the right-wing candidate cast is somebody who, if he does win the presidency, is going to roll back even the very meager advances that were achieved under the presidency of Michel Bachelet.
Hey, he said if Pinochet were alive, he'd vote for me.
Yeah, and he one of the things that is on his electoral program is to roll back any judicial proceedings against that are still outstanding from the Pinochet era in favor of the torturers and murderers that stand some faint chance at least of facing justice still.
Right.
So the AIM cast is going to put an end to that and make sure that the torturers and sadists and murderers of the Pinochet era live a happy, tranquil retirement.
And those who would engage in those activities elsewhere under the protective shield of the United States power realize they have nothing to worry about. Go ahead and continue doing business as is, because there will never be a day of atonement for you.
Right. And now that when you contrast that quite depressing outlook from our point of view in Chile with what's likely to happen this coming weekend in Honduras, and you can see that it would be very surprising if there isn't a very high turnout in Honduras, because in stark contrast to the electoral process in Chile last Sunday, and what you have in Honduras is a real choice between the continuing narco-gangster US-supported state regime led by Juan Orlando Hernandez, and once again, just as in 2017, a genuine alternative that they actually presented a national development plan. The Libre Party, Libertad and Refundación Party, they presented a quite detailed national development plan, very similar to the kind of human development plan that has been the mainstay of the Sandinista government's successful policies here in Nicaragua. And what they're talking about is very, very similar. Investment in all those areas of national life that benefit the human person, healthcare, education, support for housing, support for employment, support for small farmers, support for small producers, who are in any country, they're the backbone of the economy, but especially so in Central America, and especially so in what some people call the informal sector and what we here in Nicaragua call the popular economy.
Right.
And the people in Honduras have a genuine alternative to vote for that's been laid out for them in a quite detailed policy document, in very, very strong contrast to the complete failure of the right-wing parties in the country. There are essentially two right-wing candidates standing. One is Yanni Rosenthal for the what's left of the old Liberal Party in Honduras, and the other is this guy. I can't even remember his name now. Perhaps you can look it up, Don. I've been so focused on what's been going on in Chile, I've lost track of the other right wing candidate.
Nasby Asfour,
okay, yeah, and he's a former mayor of Tegucigalpa, and yes. I think he's had two successive terms as the mayor of Tegucigalpa, which is the capital of Honduras, notoriously corrupt, caught up in all kinds of national scandals, and also now a regional scandal that involves also a former president. The current mayor of San Jose in Costa Rica. It's called the Diamante scandal, and that involves issuing substantial contracts for public works programs in return for receiving also similarly very substantial sums of money, bribes, from the respective contractors. And that's something that this guy, the National Party candidate in Honduras, is very, very deeply embroiled in. But what in typical fashion in Honduras, there was a judicial process instigated against him that was suspended, surprise, surprise, pending the implementation of a thorough audit, and that thorough audit is unlikely to happen, at least for the foreseeable future, and certainly if this guy wins the election, and it'll just get buried. But that's just a yet another example of the kind of corruption that has characterized public life in Honduras since the coup that you mentioned back in 2009.
Right.
And I was present on the day of the coup because I'd been invited by the then Honduran government under President Mel Zelaya to participate to accompany the electoral process there in a constitutional referendum about whether or not to change the constitution, which was presented by the international media, including the New York Times, as essentially an attempt at an internal coup by Mel Zelaya, and it was completely misrepresented.
He was president
in the Western press.
He was president,
and that was the pretext for the coup back then.
Right.
So very, very shortly after that accomplished fraud and phony, possibly the most accomplished phony of the, certainly so far in this century, Barack Obama.
Oh, yeah.
He fooled people in the summit of the Americas in Trinidad and Tobago that year that the United States was somehow going to change its policy in the region. And then 2 months later, they were promoting a coup in Honduras to overthrow a progressive government.
I know.
So, you know, nothing changes.
Yeah.
But, so then, what happened in the wake of the coup was that the very strangely, the coup took place just 2 months before scheduled elections.
Right.
And then those elections were won by a guy called Porfirio Lobo of the National Party, and
right.
He was just a classic stooge for the local oligarchy and their U.S. owners.
Right. The people who staged the coup, basically. They conducted the election, and one of their boys won. You know, wow, what a miracle.
Right. And so subsequently, and there was another government, a right-wing government, and then in, I think it was, when was it?
2013.
Was it 2013 that Juan Orlando Hernandez won, and then he won again in 2017 in highly questionable elections?
Yeah, people were in the street. Yeah.
Even the Organization of American States said that those elections were hopelessly flawed.
Yep.
And even the European Union admitted that they were hopelessly flawed, but they still accepted the result in the end, which was the continuation of the corrupt murderous narco regime of Juan Orlando Hernandez.
Right.
So now what you're faced with in Honduras is this situation where Xiomara Castro, the wife of former President Mel Zelaya, who was overthrown in the 2009 coup, and she has something like a 20-point lead over the National Party candidate, and
right.
Yanni Rosenthal, the third candidate, really has very little chance of winning.
It's interesting, but, too, by the way, the 2017 election. I'm interrupt for a second, but 2017 election. The National Party candidate, who's the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, won with 42.96% of the vote, as opposed to the Libre Party candidate, who is now the vice presidential candidate, by the way, of Xiomara Castro, that's Salvador Nasralla. He lost 41.42%. In other words, 42.90%. 5% to 41.42%, about 1.5% swing. And the Liberal Party candidate then, you could call him Ralph Nader, Luis Orlando Zelaya, no relation to Mel Zelaya, the former president that was deposed in the coup, 14.74%. So, yeah. You know, there's a swing vote that's going to happen there. And otherwise, what's usually a pretty divided electorate, but the polls now show they're a really big lead for Zia Mara Castro.
Yeah, and if Zia Mara Castro doesn't win, it's very difficult to see how they're going to, well, avoid a crisis. But we know how that crisis will be resolved. And if Juan Orlando, the National Party candidate to succeed Juan Orlando Hernandez, which will just mean more of the same.
Right.
A continuation of the corrupt oligarchy's control of the region, a continuation of the wholesale handing over, and what you call looting, by the right-wing elites here, are in favor of Canadian and United States and other foreign corporations, and that's just going to go on, and to give an idea of the level of viciousness of the right-wing elites in Honduras, and very similar to their right-wing counterparts in Colombia, by the way, and over 30 candidates and party activists associated with the Libre Party have been murdered over the last couple of months in the run-up to these elections.
Right.
No, and so it's not a question of people agreeing to disagree. And these people are absolutely ruthless gangsters. That's what they are. They're a kind of dirtier version of the white collar fascists that run Chile.
Right. That's right.
What will happen if Zia Mara Castro's obvious advantage doesn't turn into a resounding electoral victory for her and her party? What will happen will be similar levels of repression that happened after 2013, after 2017, a continuing destruction of any chance of social progress for the impoverished majority in Honduras, and of course that'll intensify the pressure on migration from Honduras to the United States.
Yeah.
So,
you know, one of the problems is that, and well, it's not a problem, but it's one of the factors that has to be considered, is this reaction to these things. In other words, there are some forces or some, you know, construct of, you know, forces that are able to steal these elections, rig them and then steal them or undo them with a coup with relative impunity, consequent to alignment of power. Maybe the military is on their side. That usually is the case, as a matter of fact, but not always. The people themselves have no leadership that's capable or proven capable so far in many cases of taking them to battle, to do these things outside of constitutional means. And then the last election provoked 2 years in the streets the election. And yet, you know, here we are. Maybe we're seeing the result of that work manifest with Castro's position in the polls. Being, you know, she should win, looking at things right now, and maybe not, and maybe also people are looking, hopefully, down the pike until, you know, into next week. What do we do if, and you know, have some sort of plan ready? We've got about 30 seconds left, so
So there are two quick things to say. One is that obviously, and if the vote goes against Zia Mara Castro, all the U.S. aligned apparatus will be rolled out. The Organization of American States and the United Nations will be rolled out to somehow justify, in however mealy mouthed a way, the the unfair result. And the other thing to bear in mind is that she, even if Xiomara Castro wins, she and her new governmental team will be operating in an extremely adverse context, dominated by their right-wing enemies.
No matter what, that's right. And we'll have to leave it there and discuss this next week when we know more. Stephen, thank you very much for your time and your insights.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Let's see what happens over the weekend.
Yes, indeed.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.